Blog Talk Radio.
All right, everybody, welcome to Ron Brooks Show. It's actually been a while as I was traveling around the globe and did a lot fewer shows than I expected to while I was traveling. Time schedules just got really, really hectic. Plus, what else? Plus, time difference was just more mind-boggling this time than usual. Thanks for joining us tonight. And let's see, I did post, for those of you who missed some of the posts, maybe you're not subscribers to my YouTube channel, I put up a lot of the lectures that I gave in Europe. I've put up on the YouTube channel. There'll be some more coming in the next few days as we kind of assemble all the different video feeds of the different events that we did in Europe. But it was a, I don't know, I think it was 16 days, 7 countries, 11 events. So I think we've got video from most of those events. A few kind of messed up and didn't actually record them, but almost all of them got recorded and will be up. So a few events up, so another reason to subscribe to my YouTube channel. All right, today we're going to do a, hangout with my Patreon, my top Patreon supporters. We've got Jennifer and Jonathan with us right now. I think we're expecting one other person to join us in a few minutes. But we'll start with Jennifer and Jonathan. If you want to participate in these, although we might be changing this perk, we'll see. If you want to participate in these, then go to Patreon and make a contribution. This particular perk is available for those who contribute more than $100 a month. But patreon.com/YouronBrookShow. All right, so we'll get started. Oh, Donald Trump is on the chat on YouTube. Jonathan, Donald Trump's here. He says, hey. All right, Jonathan, can you hear us? I did a sound check with Jennifer. Jonathan doesn't look like he can hear us. Can you hear us, Jonathan? I'm getting no response from Jonathan. All right. Hey, let's see. Once then. Yeah. You're speaking, but I hear nothing, Jonathan. Can't hear you. You're muted. You're muted somewhere. Ah, there we go. Now I can hear you. All right.
I understand that people within the administration are listening to your program, so maybe the man himself is tuning in.
I doubt that, and I doubt he's on my chat, but somebody's using his photo and calling himself Donald Trump. But there is somebody in the White House who supposedly is listening to the show. It seems like they listened to the show I did on, what's his name, Peter Navarro, and he got chided the next day by administration officials. But yes, yeah, somebody in the White House claims to be listening to the show regularly, to be loving the show, and I think he said something like, whether I like it or not, there are people in the White House who like the show. I don't know what that means, but that is a direct quote. Somebody told me this who knows people in the White House, so he was told directly by this person. So who knows what our influence actually is? It's hard to tell. All right, let's see. All right, Jonathan, you're on the screen. Go with the first question.
Well, actually, just quickly, apropos of that, Yaron, could you – you've said this in the past, but just, again, apropos of your point about people in the White House listening, could you briefly tell the story of how Ayn Rand's influence helped change the draft in America today? Because it was a big issue, you know – was 35, 40 years ago, and a lot of people don't know that, and there's a little story that I'd love if you would share with me so I know it once again.
Sure. As hopefully everybody knows, in the 1960s, there was a draft in the United States. If you were 18, you were drafted into the Army. There were some exceptions if you went to college, but when you graduate from college, theoretically, you could be drafted. I don't know the details, but there was a draft. The Vietnam War was not fought with a volunteer army like wars are today, but it was fought with an army of conscripted adults, conscripted young men and women. I think it was only men. But Ayn Rand opposed the draft on the beginning. I mean, she considered the draft to be evil. It's, you know, talk about coercion and using coercion by the state in order for, you know, to exercise state power, to go to wars that the president and the state have decided are good wars, to sacrifice your life whether you believe in the war or not. So she was a huge opponent of the draft and wrote about it in the 1960s and spoke about it in the 1960s. And there were a number of people in the Nixon administration who were affiliated with Ayn Rand in those days. And maybe the most prominent in this context, probably the most important one, was Morton Anderson. And Morton Anderson was appointed to a committee that that Nixon put together to study the draft after he got elected in 1968. And the committee came back with a recommendation to eliminate the draft, which motivated Nixon ultimately to eliminate the draft. And I do not know the date of when he actually eliminated the draft. It was in the early 1970s. And Morton Anderson was clearly an influence in that committee. And he was one of Ayn Rand's kind of circle, one of the people in the so-called collective, one of the people attending some of the meetings and heavily influenced by Ayn Rand. There were probably others in that committee influenced by her. At the time, there were really only two prominent intellectuals on the right advocating for the elimination of the draft, and those were Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman. And both of them, in a sense, had representatives or had influence on the people on the committee that did away with the draft. And there's no question in my mind that she had a strong there's a strong causal relationship between her advocacy against the draft and the elimination of the draft. I think her and Milton Friedman were probably the two most important public intellectuals in the 1960s and 70s advocating for pro individual rights and pro-capitalist positions, even though, of course, she was much more principled and much more consistent in those positions. Milton Friedman was independent on the issue, and he often compromised in disastrous ways. Indeed, both of them probably made, you know, the word capitalism cool again. In the 1950s and 60s, capitalism was a swear word. It was a negative term. And by the 1970s, late 1970s, early 1980s, by the time Ronald Reagan is elected, capitalism is a positive word. And again, I think that's Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged, Capitalism Not Known Ideal, and Milton Friedman with his books on capitalism.
Do you think, that was a quick follow-up,
yeah.
Do you foresee that the draft could ever make a comeback in this country?
Yeah, I do. Maybe not quite as a draft, but there's been a lot of talk, both on the right and the left, about public service, about taking teenagers 18 and having you either join the military or do some kind of public service for a year or two. You know, George Bush supported this. I'd be shocked if Donald Trump doesn't support it. And certainly people on the left support it. So as we see an increase in nationalism, as we see greater and greater frustration with so-called, you know, snowflake generation or people, we continue to describe young people as weak and pathetic and ignorant, there'll be more and more interest in actually bringing back some kind of national or instituted some kind of national service for the cause, for a cause greater than yourself, you know, and I hear people all the time say, yeah, what these kids need is they need to go into the army. They need to be beaten up in the army a little bit, just to whip into shape, to get them straightened out. They'd be so much better if they went into the army, like those Israeli kids, you know, they need some of that.
Didn't the Institute years ago have a protest against volunteerism?
Yeah, so during the Clinton years, I think it was Clinton years, but it was really promoted by George Bush Sr. and others. Volunteerism was a big issue, and the idea of national service became a big issue. And I think there was National Service Day or something like that, or Volunteer Day was instituted. So there was definitely a variety of different programs, and it was a big, big issue. And the Institute had a protest, I think, in Philadelphia opposite Liberty Hall, and we wrote a lot of op-eds and we wrote a lot of stuff about that issue. It was a good issue for us, because who else is going to stand up against volunteerism? Nobody. So again, left and right supported that agenda. All right, Jennifer.
Do you think it's a good idea to have Supreme Court justices be appointed for life?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, maybe there should be a retirement age, but I think there's a way to get rid of them if they go senile or something. So I don't think age has ever been an issue. But the importance of it is, and this is why it's such an important position, it's that they don't have to play politics. They don't have to be reappointed, or their time horizon is indefinite. Now, you could say they can't serve more than 20 years, they can't serve more than 25 years, but I'm not sure that serves any purpose, right? Unless they've become mentally, you know, no good. You could argue that it's good to have turnover, but it doesn't seem to be a problem. There seems to be quite a bit of turnover, whether they drop dead or they just get old and retire. You're not going to get nominated to the Supreme Court until you're well into your 40s, right? How old is Kavanaugh? 48, something like that, yeah. I think. So you probably got 20, you probably got 30 years. So it seems like a reasonable time. There's a steep learning curve. There's a maturing process. So I think as long as you're appointing judges in their 40s and 50s, and those are relatively young judges, yeah, I think a lifetime appointment makes sense. And I certainly don't think they should be renominated. That is, that you should have a term of 10 years and then can renominate. If you had a term, that would be it. You'd have to leave after the end of that term. So maybe you could have 20-year terms and then you'd leave. But it would have to be a lengthy period. But it's the only position in government in the separation of powers that really has a lifetime appointment. So it's and you know, that's pretty substantial.
Thank you.
Sure. Jonathan, well, let me do this. I'm going to do some of these contributor topics that Patreon contributors voted on. We'll do that as well. And of course, we always take Super Chat questions. So if anybody's interested on YouTube to ask something on Super Chat, today's your opportunity. So this is from Reed McGrew. How do you answer the environmentalists who claim the 97% of scientists? I don't know if they mean all scientists or specifically climatologists, believe in man-caused global warming and its future disastrous impact. So what do you say to them when they say that? So I think you have to separate a few things here. One is, that's a bogus statistic, right? It's not 97%. There is no such thing. So you have to say something like, well, you know, that 97% thing that you've read about, that's bogus. That's not real. But it's true that a large percentage, probably a majority, probably an overwhelming majority of scientists who are willing to state an opinion, believe in man-made caused global alarm. And then you have to say something about, science is not about a vote. Science is not a democracy. It's not about a majority. And then I think you have to say, because at this point they're thinking, oh God, he denies climate change and he's rejecting science or whatever. So there's a danger there. So then what you have to do is say, I mean, this is what I do. Alex Epstein does it differently. What I do is then I say, I don't have a position on whether the globe is warming or not. And I don't even really have a position about whether it's man-made or not, because I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is, even if it is warming, even if it is man-made, what do you do about it? And even if it is warming, even if it is man-made, why do you care? Why is the world getting warmer upset you so much? Why are you getting so excited about, you know, a few more degrees of heat? I actually like the idea of, I use the Canada becomes habitable funny line, which people respond to positively, because everybody thinks Canada, except Canadians, thinks Canada. And people who live like in Maine and Minnesota think Canada is uninhabitable. So I guess Jennifer actually thinks Canada is habitable because she lives in Michigan and up, you know, in the cold, really freezing part of Michigan. And then you get into discussion about what are the proposals about dealing with climate change, and how those are nuts, and how those are ridiculous, and how those are incredibly damaging, and how those proposals reveal how, in a sense, unserious the people who claim that climate change is an issue are. That is, the proposals are worse, the proposed solutions are worse than any imaginable problem. And I also throw in there, you know, I throw in a line that goes something like, you know, I'm a finance guy, and if you want me to invest in your fund, then one of the first things I ask you is, how have you done in the past? And if you say, well, really badly, then, you know, forget it. You know, past performance is no necessarily indicator of future performance, but it certainly is a starting point, right? If all your performance in the past has been negative, I'm not interested in listening to the pitch.
Reversion to the mean. Come on, girl.
Yeah, right. Everything just reverts the mean automatically. So the same goes with scaremongering. If you're telling me the world is going to end tomorrow, I want to know how good you have been in your scaremongering predictions in the past. So if you were the same people who predicted that overpopulation and mass starvation, if you were the same people who predicted everybody would have cancer because of chemicals, if you were the same people who predicted that global cooling would happen, if you're the same people who predicted, you know, just any, what was it, the ozone hole or a million other things would end life on planet Earth as we know it, then I can't take you that seriously. I just can't. But I think the main issue is the solution, right? And the solution can't be not to use fossil fuels. And that solution is revealing of the true motivation, of the true insanity of the position and everything else that's going on. So that's how I deal with it kind of quickly. Of course, if you wanted to deal with it in a more fundamental sense, you'd have to get into the science. And I say, look, I'm not a scientist. I don't have a strong position about whether there's global warming or not, about whether it's man-made or not. And that's a fact. I don't have a strong position about it. Again, I'm suspicious of those claiming there is. But that's not enough for me to say there's no such thing. I haven't looked at the data closely enough. I haven't examined the evidence closely enough. My suspicion is that there is global warming. My suspicion is man-made factors probably play a small role in that warming. And my strong suspicion is that warming is not going to be catastrophic. All right. Let's see. Okay, Jonathan, Jennifer, and then we'll do some super chats.
I have one, but Jennifer, you go first. I'm just formulating.
Okay. What do you think about people telling the kids Santa Claus is real?
Well, since I have a huge amount of respect for some people who tell their kids Santa Claus is real, I can't say horrible things about those people because I Leonard Peikoff told his daughter Santa Claus was real as a form of fantasy. And, you know, he's argued it's a healthy thing and there's nothing bad about it. There's nothing wrong about it as long as it's a game, as long as it's fantasy. I couldn't do it with my kids. It seemed too ridiculous and fantasy I always presented as fantasy, so it was very clear what the boundaries were, because I think when they're little they can't tell the difference. So I'm not a proponent of telling your kids that there is a Santa Claus, but given that Lena Peikoff did and has an argument for why you should, I'm not making too strong of a claim about it one way or the other. I think it's somewhat optional. Obviously, if they ask you seriously after a certain age, you shouldn't lie to them. But I couldn't do it. I couldn't play that game.
I couldn't do it either.
Yeah. I think it's fine not to do it. All right, Jonathan, you got
Ron, I have a selfish, practical question to ask you. Obviously, I'm starting to get out there with my new book. And, you know, I've followed your career all over the world, making books by your own blood, sweat, and tears into national bestsellers and international bestsellers.
I don't know about
what
that.
Works, what, in your sense, really works practically in terms of spreading ideas on the ground? Is it social media? Is it the live speeches that you do all over the world? What really works until, I'd say moving product, but I mean moving ideas and moving product.
I mean, I think it's a combination of all of the above. I don't think there's one thing that works, because I think they everything feeds off of each other, right? I think in the day we live in today, you have to use social media. And you have a big social media base. You know, you have a lot of followers on Twitter. You should use that. So really linking your social media presence with the book, I think is really, really crucial. So, something like an appearance of yours that people might be interested in, but linked to, hey, the author of da-da-da-da-da of is on Neil Cavuto today, and here's a clip from the video. But it also always present yourself as author of, not just as Jonathan Honing, so that the book title always gets in there and gets its own hashtag.
Good. And I remember what I really wanted to ask, so let me ask that instead.
Okay.
I was listening to some of your old presentations in front of a lot of old groups. You would often position yourself. I don't want to say that, but almost. Speak as being on the right, you know, those of on the right. I mean, not explicitly, but has that changed for you personally? I mean, do you associate yourself as being on the right at all anymore? Or are you just in no man's land now? And has that changed for you in the last couple of years?
Yeah, I'd say it's changed in the last three years or so. Yes, I used to accept Ayn Rand's description of the right as being pro-individual rights, pro-capitalism, the left being anti-individual rights, anti-capitalism. But it seemed like a losing battle to fight for those terms. And to me, they seem unimportant as terms. That is, there's certain terms you want to fight for, selfishness, capitalism, and what they actually mean. Right, left, doesn't seem important. And the way people are using right and left more and more and more, and certainly with Donald Trump, and what's happening today, much doesn't reflect this spectrum of pro-individual rights, anti-individual rights, doesn't reflect the real spectrum in politics that I think exists, which is collectivism versus individualism. So I've tried to stop using left and right. It still slips out because it's convenient. But it's very, I think, ultimately destructive, because people who agree with us know what you mean. But people who don't agree with you, people particularly out there in the public, when they hear right, they think Donald Trump. When they hear right, they think fascism. When they hear right, they think the Republican Party. When they hear right, they think David Duke and the Ku Klux Klan. And we might want to say, no, those are all leftists because they're all statists. It doesn't work. Nobody buys it, because you do have to differentiate between the Ku Klux Klan and Black Lives Matter. There is a difference, right? They're not the same. Now, maybe they're both statists, they're both collectivists, but they're collectivists in different ways. Their racism manifests itself in different ways. So they are racists of the right, and these are racists of the left. And there's a difference there. So I think there's some usefulness to differentiating between Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump. But that usefulness does not measure itself on a spectrum that goes from individualism to collectivism. It measures itself on the spectrum of their positions on a variety of different issues that relate more to the type of statism they want to embrace. So the difference between Trump and Pelosi are minimal as compared to the difference between Trump, Pelosi, and us. That's the real difference. That's the real chasm.
Because I am, in a quick and follow-up, I am seeing people online essentially quote Ayn Rand as identifying the left as the enemy and the right as the side to be on, in effect. I don't remember the exact source. I can look it up. Maybe some of your followers.
Yeah. It was on Facebook recently. Somebody put it up kind of to show me that I disagree with Ayn Rand. Yeah. That Ayn Rand said, the right is individual rights and capitalism and the left is the enemy. And therefore, anybody who's anti-individual rights and capitalism really belongs on the left. Yeah, good luck with that. I mean, that's not how the terms are used today. That's not how anybody understands them. There's no usefulness in holding on to that and in fighting that particular battle. And it's funny because those people, then if you say, oh, so you mean Donald Trump is way on the left? They would go, no, wait a minute. You know, they would try to challenge, that idea. So
I like capitalist or individualist. I think that's about specific as you get.
Yeah. I think individualist versus collectivist, capitalist versus statist. That and statist, you can split between left statist and right statist, but they're all statists. So that's the way I think of it. And I've been advocating for that on this show for, I think, about 3 years. So, really making this issue of I'm not right, I'm not left, I'm an individualist. And neither left nor right are individualists.
Thank you.
All right. With Jackie Chan and Buster Keaton pursuing their rational self-interest by performing life-threatening stunts for their art. Wow. I think they were. I think given that what they were doing was part of an artistic endeavor, not a stunt for the sake of a stunt, but a stunt for the sake of something greater. And they didn't have the technical ability and technical knowledge to get around the stunt, in other words, to do special effects. I think they felt like in order for the artwork to have integrity, they had to actually do these crazy things. So it was part of the art. The thing I said, I think one of the last times when I was asked a question about stuntmen, is stunts for the sake of stunts, I don't think are rational. Position yourself in a life-threatening situation for the sake of showing off or for the sake of proving to yourself that you can do it. It's not the same as for the sake of a work of art. This is one component within a greater whole. So that's my view on that. Let me just go through a few of these. What do you think of the ethicalness? Ethicalness, there's a word. Ethicalness of eating pork. I've heard credible people say pigs may be too smart to eat. No. No. Maybe dogs are too smart to eat. I don't even think that's true. Maybe chimpanzees are too smart to eat. I wouldn't eat a chimpanzee. But short of that, no. Pork is wonderful. What's wrong with pork? This is a couple of Jews here commenting on the fact that pork is delicious. I don't get that. I don't even know what being too smart to eat means. The thing that makes something unedible, I think the two things that make something unedible. One is that it has the capacity to reason, i.e. it's human. That would take it out of the realm, for individual rights reasons, out of the realm of edible, right? And second, likability. You don't eat dogs, not because you care about the specific dog that's being eaten, but did you care about your dog? And You can't imagine eating your dog, right? And as a consequence, you would never eat a dog because in your mind, that would be equivalent to eating your dog. So I have no problem with the Chinese eating dogs, fine. But, you know, I know people who really love dogs like Jonathan. I don't, but like Jonathan. And I think about what the idea of eating a dog would probably do to Jonathan. And since I like Jonathan, I'm not going to eat dogs. It's something like that. It's something related to your particular values, and your values would exclude eating those animals that you particularly like. So I can imagine somebody growing pigs who you know, they're these little cute pigs, I guess. I don't know, piglets or whatever. And you won't eat them because you've had them as a pet all your life. But it's not an issue of being too smart. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, anyway, I don't think that has anything to do with it. Either you're human or you're not. If you're not human, it's okay to eat you. And then it's just a question of, are you, as an eater, do you want to eat this particular animal? Is that consistent with your values? And I think for a lot of animals, the answer would be no. I mean, but then there's also, there are other reasons why you wouldn't want to eat certain animals. Disgust, it goes against your religious beliefs or whatever. All right, let's do another one quickly.
What a mark of amazing affluence now that, like, we can really choose what we want to eat.
Yeah.
And we can grow fake meat and eat that. And
there's real science now to growing. It hasn't become commercial yet, but there's a company in Israel that is really close to making fake meat taste like real meat and have the texture of real meat and artificially created meat. I mean, that's pretty cool.
It's called barbecue sauce.
No, no. You pour barbecue sauce over what? Are you a vegetarian, Jonathan? I didn't get it. I missed something. All right. What do we have? If objectivism is going to dominate, why will it take going through a dark ages before it is rediscovered? Isn't it more likely for it to happen now when we have free speech in the internet? I don't know that a dark ages has to happen before it's rediscovered, but it's going to take a long time. I don't think that there'll be a dark ages. I just think there'll be some tough periods in front of us, you know, but I don't think we're going to enter another dark ages for reasons that I gave in my talk about why I'm a rational optimist. So you can watch that on my YouTube channel. Why I'm a rational optimist, or being an irrational optimist, something like that it's called, where I talk about why I don't think we're going to go through a dark ages, where I think there's a good chance that economically we will sustain ourselves. Why can't it happen now? It won't happen now because people are not convinced, and it takes a long time to convince them, and it takes a long time to figure out the ways in which to convince them. Like, I mean, look at this show, for example. I mean, people don't like when I complain, and I'm not really complaining. I'm just giving you facts. The fact is that only, you know, a few thousand people listen to this show. Now, that might be a lot, but it's not when you compare it to Peterson or to, you know, Ben Shapiro or to, I don't know, countless people on the left or you know, any talk show, radio talk show host on the left or on the right. So the voice of objectivism right now out there in the culture is very small. Ayn Rand's books sell, but they don't sell as much as they did, let's say, 5 years ago. And what happened to all those books that sold? Why aren't people convinced? So it takes a lot to change a culture. And I think it takes generations to change a culture. You have to train intellectuals who then continuously think about how to present these ideas in ways that will convince people. They continuously have to iterate and try things and persuade and experiment and go at it again until we convince a large enough number. I don't think it has to be a majority, but a large enough number of people that these ideas are true. And only then, you know, can you really start having a massive, significant impact on the culture. So it just takes a long, long time for the intellectuals who are advocating for these ideas to get the word out, to figure out the most convincing ways to do it, and to get more and more and more intellectuals. At the end of the day, the world has changed through intellectuals. It's not through the masses. It's through intellectuals. The masses follow, and the masses follow the dominant intellectual views of the time. So if you think about that, how long does it take to train an intellectual? If you get them in beginning of an undergraduate, that's 4 years of undergraduate school, another 6 years of PhD program, it's minimum of 10 years from the time you discover a kid until they're a junior intellectual. And then there's probably another 10 years until they learn their craft. So you're looking at 20 years to create one. In every generation like that, you're not going to get more than 5, 10. Okay, so times 20 years, that's maybe 200. How many of them are going to be any good? Probably only 50. So over 20 years, you'll get 50 intellectuals. We need 5,000. So that's what? A few thousand years of work? About 100 years of work. Now, there are economies of scale, so it doesn't have to be quite as many. You could argue in a variety of different ways. But we're talking about 50 to 100 years to change the world. That's what it's going to take. Not because you have to go through the dark ages, but because it takes a long time to convince large numbers of people, even with today's technology. Even with today's technology. The nice thing about technology is you can convince people across a much larger geographic space. So it's global, so you can get more people, but then there's also more people to convince because the world is bigger. There are more people that have to buy into these ideas. It's just a numbers game. I mean, it's not just a numbers game, but if you just look at it as a numbers game, you realize the magnitude of the problem. Think of all the intellectuals who teach at all the universities, who teach all the high school teachers, who then teach all the high school kids. Think of all the intellectuals at the New York Times, Washington Post, and all the media outlets. And then think of all the intellectuals who are at think tanks and nonprofits and advocacy groups and lobbyists. And then think of all the objectivists you know on planet Earth. And that gives you the scale. And then think of the number of objectivists who are intellectuals who actually speak up on these issues. And again, you get a sense of the magnitude, just the sheer number of people that have to be replaced in order to make this work. All right. I'm going to take one of these Patreon contributor topics, and then we'll go back to Jennifer and Jonathan, and then we'll do some more super chat. What is the cause of – oh, this is a good question. What is the cause of the don't judge me or you cannot judge me mentality among some individuals, especially the young? How can one discuss, demonstrate the necessity of judging to others? I mean, it's a really good question and a difficult question. It's not an easy question. So I think there are a number of issues going on here. I think there are two fundamental issues. One is, if you don't have self-esteem, in other words, if you're not confident in your ability to live this life on this earth, if you're not confident in your own capacity to think, to reason, to discover, to produce, to take care of yourself, then somebody judging you is a threat. Because what are you going to do with it? Because in a sense you've given up on your own mind, you completely depend on other people's mind. Because you've given up, you don't have the confidence to decide for yourself or to do things for yourself. You need the judgment of others, the positive judgment of others, to guide you, right? And judging is difficult. It's challenging. It's hurtful. It shakes your self-confidence. You have no self-esteem. So you can't handle negative evaluations, right? Now, of course, what lack of self-esteem leads to is emotionalism. So you're completely dependent on your emotions because self-esteem comes from the use of one's mind. It comes from the commitment to rationality. It comes from commitment to being challenged and achieving those challenges through the use of your mind. Your lack of self-esteem is probably a consequence of the fact that you haven't applied your mind consistently. You haven't challenged yourself, and you're uncomfortable and lack confidence in your own capacity to reason. And if you lack confidence in your reason, then what are you left with? You're left with your emotions. And those emotions need to be guarded because you don't want negative emotions. Negative emotions are a bad sign. So you have to guard against negative emotions. And again, negative emotions are consequences here of being judged, of being told. And of course, so don't judge me really means don't, you know, challenge me. Don't contradict me. Don't tell me anything negative. And it's a consequence of this lack of self-esteem and this inherent emotionalism. Now, often both the lack of self-esteem and the inherent emotionalism are consequences of altruism. Altruism is this idea that other people's lives are more important than yours, that your purpose in life is to serve others. And nobody actually holds that, but what altruism does effectively, while it doesn't effectively cause people to go out and a massive sacrifice themselves to the common good, people just don't do that, luckily for all of us. What they do is undercut themselves. What altruism tells us is you shouldn't love yourself. You shouldn't care about yourself. You shouldn't place your own interests first. And it teaches you, it doesn't teach you how to be selfish, how to pursue self-interest, which of course undercuts your self-esteem, which leads to this whole chain of events. Altruism ultimately leads a person to distrust himself because pursuing your own self-interest is immoral. It's bad. It's evil in some sense. Now, even if you don't buy into that completely, there's enough altruism in the culture, you buy into enough altruism in the culture to give you doubt. And that doubt festers and that doubt causes you to distrust anything that is selfish, which makes self-esteem impossible, which again channels you towards emotionalism. Now, you can go even to the epistemological level in a sense that we live in a world where we are taught that there are no absolutes. Reality doesn't really exist. There is no truth. Reason is impotent. So who are you to judge? To judge, you must reason. To judge, you must evaluate. To judge, you must have facts. To judge, you must be able to be objective. Modern epistemology says none of those are possible. And if none of those are possible, you can't judge. You can't judge me because it's actually impossible to judge. Epistemologically impossible. That's what postmodernism teaches us. But what's what a lot of post-Kantian philosophy teaches is the impossibility of actually gaining objective knowledge of reality. Then what's the basis of judging? Now, to show somebody that judgment is important, one has to first show somebody that their life is important, that they should care about their own life. And then one has to show them how judging others is important to their own life, why they have to do it if they want to live and if they want to be successful, and how the judgment of others can actually help them be a better person. So not only do they have to judge in order to be a better person, they also have to be willing to be judged and view being judged as an opportunity. I mean, this is my approach to criticism. Granted, I don't always live up to it, but this is the rational approach to criticism, right? Somebody criticizes you. There are two possibilities. They're either right or they're wrong. If they're right in their criticism of you, the only rational response is to say, thank you. You've learned something new. You've just been corrected. You're closer to the truth. Your life is better for having been criticized. If they're wrong, Why do you care? If they're wrong, why do you care? They're wrong. It's their problem. It's their life. They've got a falsehood. You know, you can try to correct them to the extent that they're of value to you and them knowing the truth is of value to you, but you don't owe them that. And in either case, you don't have to get upset because it doesn't mean anything to you. It doesn't mean anything for your life. What matters to you is the truth, not who knows the truth. Now, if there's somebody close to you that you care about and you want them to know the truth, then you try to convince them of the truth. But the level to which you engage with that person depends very much on how close they are to you, how important they are to you. All right, anybody want to follow up on that one? All right, so we're going to go to Jennifer now.
What do you think of hunting not for food, but I guess they call it trophy hunting, you know, just blowing the head off an elephant just for the heck of it?
I mean, I don't like it because, I mean, here's a thing of beauty and a thing that's alive. And what, I mean, particularly given that it's not really challenging, you could do the same in target practice. I guess I'm not excited about hunting. I get why, but I wouldn't ban it, right? And I wouldn't say it's always immoral. I can get that some people could get a real objective value from it. I'm not interested. I don't think I would be that friendly with people who are. I see a lion. I see what a beautiful animal a lion is. Why would I want to kill it? I mean, wow. I mean, it's just a magnificent beast. And now, of course, I'd kill it if it was trying to kill me, or I'd kill it if it was eating my food. I'd kill it if there was an existential reason to kill it. But just for fun seems to me disrespectful of life and the beauty of life. But again, I wouldn't necessarily consider it immoral. It would really depend on the motivation of the person. That makes sense?
Yeah.
All right. Jonathan?
Of all the places you've been, your own, where haven't you been in the world that you'd like to be invited?
Invited? Where would I like to be invited?
Where haven't you been that maybe we can kickstart to send you?
Oh, I know. I'm trying to think. I mean, I think the top destination I have right now that I've never been to that I'd like to go to and like to go and give a talk is Singapore. I've never been to Singapore. I've never given a talk in Singapore. You'd think it would be a place where there'd be a lot of interest in the message. It would be a lot of kind of capitalists are there. A lot of very productive people are there. And yeah, Singapore is probably the number one place I haven't spoken in that I'd like to speak. I've spoken so many places. And then after that, I'd say Africa. And I don't know when Africa pick a place. I'd certainly like to go to South Africa. I've been there, but I'd like to go speak there. I've never spoken in South Africa. I hear good things about Rwanda in a sense of being a pretty amazing place right now in terms of real interest in capitalism and capitalist ideas. And I'd love to be able to go there and reinforce that by speaking there and encouraging them on, because it's very brave and courageous in the world we live in to be in Africa and to, and to be engaged in capitalism. Louise asked, how about India? I mean, I don't want to offend anybody, right? I'm just not excited about India. There are a lot of people there who are interested in objectivism. There are a lot of Ayn Rand fans. But there's just something very unappetizing about India. Maybe it's Slumdog Millionaire. And just the poverty is so out there, and it's in such quantity. I don't know. There's something about my sense of India that I don't get about other countries, that I didn't get in China, I didn't even get in Cambodia, I don't even get in Africa. I don't know. I'd have to, I'd obviously go to India if I was invited because of the level of interest and how many people are there. But I'm just not excited about going to India. And maybe I should be. So maybe if I go, I'll change my mind. I have to admit, I wasn't excited about going to China the first time I went to China. I thought, nah, China, who cares? It's all fake. It's unreal. And then I was blown away. My complete change of mind with regard to China once I went there and spent time. And I've been to China many times since. And wow, it's an impressive place. It's an impressive place. So Singapore, Africa, India, I guess, are the other places. So you're going to start a campaign, Jonathan? All right. We've got some. You can if you want. I'm good with that. Now, I'm having Jonathan on my show. We have a date, right? In December.
Yes.
Do you remember the date?
Yes. The date is...
It's in December. It's like in a couple of weeks.
Oh, it is. Yes, December 12th.
Okay, so December 12th, Jonathan is going to be on the Iran Book Show. We're going to do, I'm going to interview him about, or we're going to have a discussion about the book, the new textbook of Americanism. Say something, because if you're not speaking, they can't see the image of the book.
Yes, I'm delighted to be. We'll be talking about it and discussing it and all the promotion that you've done about it. Yep. And the Institute has done about it. I'm delighted already.
Yeah, so go buy the book and read the book before we have the interview. And then you can ask questions about the book during my session with Jonathan. So it'll be fun. We'll open up the Super Chat and we'll take your questions and we'll have a conversation. And yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. And we'll get to know Jonathan a little bit more than maybe all of us know, because I'm going to ask him some personal questions and all kinds of other stuff. He doesn't even know. All right. Here's a out of nowhere question. Could the U.S. beat Russia and China in a ground war at the same time? In a ground war. So I'm assuming you're saying no nukes. Where would the ground war be fought? In the U.S., in China, in Russia, in Europe, in Asia? What would the circumstances be? So my answer is a tentative yes, depending on the particulars and the concretes that you would have to posit. I don't think you're going to see a ground war between the United States, Russia, and China. Not happening. Too much to lose because of the nukes. All right, we got another question. For young kids, how to introduce individualism where public schools become collective? You just got to treat them as individuals. You got to give them individual responsibility. You've got to and you've got to talk about the world from an individualist perspective. You've got to model individualism. And then you've got to combat what they learn in history, which is so collectivist, and what they learn maybe in economics, which is so collectivist, with an individualistic alternative. Not easy, but you just got to keep plugging away. Figure out what they're learning in school and offer the alternatives. Alternatives to what they tell them about war, alternatives to what they tell them about economics, alternatives to what they tell them about politics. You're going to have those alternatives. So alternatives to what they tell them about environmentalism, which is probably the most evil thing they're taught when they're very, very young. All right. Whenever I find a contradiction in life, I add to a document called Yuan's Questions. Thank you. So here's the contradiction that I have to answer. You're supposed to answer these. Why do brilliant scientists who make discoveries that improve the whole world not get compensated well financially? First of all, how do you know they don't get compensated well financially? And how do we know what they would be compensated, what would they be compensated in a true free market, right? So it's really hard to tell. Now, it's true that they would never get compensated financially as much as a Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos. And that is because they don't have as a direct, immediate impact on people's lives as much as Bezos and Jobs and Gates and people like that, and businessmen. Businessmen take science and convert it into impact, convert it into values that people value, that individuals value. Individuals, for the most part, don't value in their day-to-day lives the discoveries of great scientists. What they value, whoa, what was that? Angela, there's feedback since you came on. Oh, hey. It's not Angela. So the scientist doesn't, the average person does not value the scientist's new theory, qua theory. What they value is how it applies to their life, because they don't understand the theory. Most people don't know whether it's a great theory or not. So the scientist is, since what you get compensated on is based on what people actually value in their day-to-day lives, not on, in quotes, the true value that you're giving, that you're providing humanity over generations, which is what a scientist designs. And Ayn Rand talks about this explicitly in an, I think, one of her best essays. I also think it's one of her hardest essays to understand. It's a really complicated essay called, it's the first essay in Capitalism, Not Known Ideal, and it has a pretty innocuous title. The title is, What is Capitalism? And oh my God, is it a hard, complicated, complex, deep. And one of the concepts she discusses there, man, this is worth so much more than $10, Ori Johnson Young, Super Chat, $10. This is worth a lot more than that because this is hard stuff. She talked about two types of value, socially objective value and metaphysically objective value. And she talks about the fact that in her day, I don't know what you would call it, a receptionist would, values her lipstick more than she values, I'm trying to think of, Darwin's theory of evolution. She uses a different example, which I can't remember. She values her lipsticks more than in those days she values jet airplanes. And she will buy her lipstick, and that's her value. And if there are enough people who value lipstick, then the guy who, and it could be that he has contributed something to lipstick making that nobody else has, and he will make a fortune, as many cosmetics fortunes have been made off of serving lipstick to many, many people. It changes the lives of billions of people, that ability to have lipstick or makeup or whatever it happens to be. Whereas you might enter the airplane space, and you might be in an incredibly competitive space. It might be very difficult to differentiate yourself. And the amount of money you make by providing a service that you would argue is objectively superior, and it wasn't metaphysically objective values, it was objective value versus, metaphysically objective value versus socially objective value. Socially objective value is the value that the marketplace determines for a product. It's, in a sense, what is valued by the people within society as reflected by their behavior in the marketplace. And the fact is that the behavior of people in the marketplace suggests that they value iPhones more than books on quantum mechanics. Even though quantum mechanics, more valuable in a sense of what products it can create ultimately, bring into existence, than the iPhone itself. But I don't know that. So what dies to me, this is because of egoism, what's important to me is the impact you have on my life as an individual. So the scientist is going to get compensated by those people who value the scientist's contribution. Universities, businesses who invest in science, individuals who might contribute and make grants and towards scientific endeavors. But the marketplace of products doesn't value scientists that much. And this is where, you know, I often say in my talk on inequality, life's not about money. This is where life's not about money. And money is not a measure of the value you've created. So, for example, Ayn Rand created objectivism, a once-a-millennium system of philosophy that is going to change the world of human beings. You know, it's going to have an impact for millennia on the state of human beings. She made good money, but she never made as much money as Jeff Bezos, and at some point the copyright will expire, and there'll be no money associated with Atlas Shrugged and all the philosophical knowledge that Ayn Rand has created. It's just not, there's no way to monetize it in a way that would make them monetarily reflect the value they've created. Monetary value comes from the value individual human beings in a particular culture place on the thing that you have created. Oftentimes, they will value things that might not be that important, and people will get rich off of things that are not that important. But that's voluntarily what people do, and you have to respect that that's their values. That's why she said that's a socially objective value versus a metaphysically objective value, which is the actual value of the thing for mankind from the perspective of somebody who has a grasp of history, the future, and the value that is really being created at the moment, you know, by this new innovation, this new scientific theory, and so on. So hopefully that answered your question, but we could do a whole show on that because it really is. he just gave me another $10 because I said it was a hard question. He's got a bunch of questions here. Oh, he has. All right, we're going to get to his second $10 questions in a minute. What do you think of the movie Free Solo? Haven't seen it. Sorry. I'm not crazy about Star Wars. Is that Star Wars movies? I never have been. I know that's, what is that? I think a lot of people are offended now that I'm not a huge Star Wars geek. And I certainly don't like the new ones, and I don't get it. And like, series should end. You can't just going on and making prequels and sequels and, you know, new time. It's just, there's no end to it. Give me a break. I mean, the story is, it's not that good of a story. It's not that interesting. The characters are not that good to justify this endless. It's like the superhero movies. I'm finished. Done. Never watching another one again in my life. You can't pay me enough to go see another Captain America, you know, fights Captain Zombie, whatever. I don't know what it is. But the universe, you know, there's only so many stories you can tell with people with super talents, right? How about returning to actual human beings? Regular, normal, good human beings, exceptional human beings, without any superpowers. All right, here's one more from... No, this is somebody else. Okay. So, Ori, thank you for the extra $10. I appreciate it. And I'm going to wait on this. And I'm going to go to Darius, who's joined us. And I know he was, I guess, eager to ask a question because I think he's been trying to join us for a while. Go ahead, Darius.
Hey, Ron.
Hey.
Sorry about that. I had issues with the Zoom. the link.
Yeah.
So, great. Let's see. I had a few questions, but with the seeing that I joined late, let me pick my question here.
Yep.
Okay. So you've talked a number of times about the idea that Obama was a nihilist and wanted to destroy things.
Well, I think a borderline nihilist. I don't think he's a committed nihilist. I think okay. Obama. I don't think Obama's as bad as some people think he is was. I don't think he's good, but I don't think he's quite as nihilistic as some would suggest he is. He was.
Okay.
I think it was the closest nihilist we've had.
Okay. So yeah, I'm not seeing that, and I don't get that. When I think of Obama, I think of a big statist, a Rawlsian egalitarian. And I think of nihilist, I think of somebody who wakes up and says life means nothing, and then you die.
Well,
I'm not seeing the relationship between those two.
Yeah, I mean, I think a nihilist is somebody.
He built a lot of things, even though we just, you know, I wish he hadn't done those things. But
yeah, but why did he build it? The question is, why did he build it? So the point is this: nobody actually wakes up and says, "I hate life." I mean, very few people wake up. I hate life. I hate existence. I hate the world. I'm gonna go destroy things. Like the five people who do that, right? The shooters who go into schools and do shootings and things like that.
Yeah.
Most people have a deep resentment towards the world. Most people have a deep hatred towards the world, but it doesn't manifest itself consciously. That is, it doesn't come up to the point where they say, like Ellsworth Tui, I'm going to destroy that which I resent. Instead, it's a mixture of evasion and self-delusion. So take Obamacare. Obamacare has to fail. It's built to fail. He knows it's built to fail. He doesn't care that it's built to fail. Now, partially his explanation for that is, I want universal health care. But universal health care provides inferior service. It kills people. He knows it kills people. Everybody knows it kills people. Bernie Sanders knows it's killed people. But they evade that. Why do they evade that? Because they don't really care. Because they want to see the current system destroyed. They want to bring it down. It's not that they think to themselves, I want to destroy capitalism. I want to destroy America. That's all I can think about. No, but deep down, that's the motivation. They won't put it into words, because if they put it into words, what would happen to them is what happened to James Taggart at the end of Atlas Shrugged. That's the point of that scene, is when a human being like that realizes his own evil, realizes that he's evil. Human psychology is not, very rare cases can he cope with that. They go crazy or they commit suicide, which is what happens to shooters. When the shooters realize they shoot other people, but they can't live with shooting other people. They have to kill themselves. There's no, I mean, insanity of it. They cannot survive living. Now, a few of them live afterwards, but it's very, very rare. And so what happens to these people is what really motivates them deep down philosophically is hatred and disgust. And then they create rationalizations for what they're doing. No, they're people who are uninsured and I'm just trying to save them. But you're not. If you look long term, they're going to have lousy health. No, but you know, forget long term. It's going to look, it works in Sweden. It works in England. It works, but people are dying in England. No, we could do it better than the way the English do it. So they're constantly rationalizing their own evil, because what's the alternative? They can't face it. And you can't force them to face it. They won't face it. So they constantly build these systems to hide it from themselves. Now, if you read Rand's nonfiction essay, she always talks about this psychological element to altruism, to evil, to statism, to statists. There is the psychology of not being able to look yourself what you're really doing, and therefore have to build up these rationalizations in order to be able to survive. Now, again, I don't think he's as vicious as some of these professors. See, a lot of the professors, because they don't actually have to do anything. If you're a politician, you're in the business of doing. You can actually make it real, right? He could have pressed the button and blown the world up theoretically, right?
Right.
So I don't think people who go into politics are inclined to literally be there for the sake of destruction. They pretend to themselves and they sell to their followers. And people won't elect them if that was their only goal. They sell to their followers that they have a positive to offer, even though they don't. And even though at some level, they know they don't. I don't know if that helps, but...
It does help. Thank
okay.
you.
Sure. All right, why don't you ask one other question, and then let me see. I've got two Super Chat questions. No more Super Chat questions, guys, because I'm running out of time. So do you have another one, Davis?
Sure.
Okay.
Okay. Recently, you mentioned you were talking about immigration, and you kind of made the case for immigration based on based in part on the immigration in 1900.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking, you know, doesn't the argument need to be just a moral argument? I mean, the 1900 situation is not today. It's the supply demand issues were different then than they are today. And doesn't it just come down to a moral issue? You know, we should be free to deal with labor as we want, and we'll do so based on, you know, the market price for labor, and supply and demand will dictate how rational that is.
Yes. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a moral issue, but I would never say anything is just a moral issue, because morality divorced from practicality, you're not going to sell it. It has to work too, right? And it does, right? The beauty of the way Rand derived her morality is that built into the system is the moral is the practical, and the practical is the moral. So you could say, look, capitalism is the only system that leaves free human beings from force, and therefore who cares if it works or not? It's the only moral system. But we don't only do that, and Ayn Rand spends capitalism as unknown ideal. There's a whole series of essays that just deal with the economics of capitalism. And look, it works. Look at the beauty of it, right? So you got to do both. You got to make them all argument and then show that it works. And the reason I don't think the 19th century is that far divorced. And, you're right that it's a supply-demand question. But we don't know what the supply-demand is today because we don't have a opener immigration system, right? We don't have the ability of employers to go freely to pick employees. And we don't have as many entrepreneurs coming into the United States. So we don't have as many businesses being created in the United States. So I believe that if you had an open immigration system in the US, I mean, not open immigration in the sense that anybody can come anytime with no screening, no holds bar, but if you had some kind of job qualification system or capital qualification system or entrepreneur qualification system, given that we live in a welfare state, many of the people who come to the US would be the brightest, the most eager, the most entrepreneurial. So the smartest people in Sweden don't actually want to live in Sweden. They'd rather live in California. But they're not going to come here illegally, because life in Sweden is still pretty good. So they're not going to risk that to come to the United States illegally. The people who come here illegally are the people who have nothing to lose. So they're third world country people. But people from first world countries don't come to the US illegally because there's too much to lose. And then legally, it's just so difficult. It's impossible. So they just don't come. So I think we underestimate how many of the smartest Swedes, right, would, this is purposefully because the left uses Sweden as their ideal, how many of the smartest Swedes would leave Sweden and come to the US if we had a much more open immigration system? And therefore they would create jobs. And therefore the whole supply and demand is not static. It's not a zero sum game, right? It's not a fixed pie. So immigration creates jobs. So I think we have to show that. And you can show it morally. You can show the case for immigration morally. You can show economically, just the economic theory of how it works. And then I think some historical examples are always good to have, even if they're not perfect. No historical example is perfect,
yeah.
But you have to extrapolate what's meaningful and what's not from historical examples.
Yeah, that's fair.
All right, Jennifer, Jonathan, and then I'm going to wrap up with some super chat questions. Jennifer?
Do you think that harsh punishment is an actual deterrent to crime? Some people say it's not.
Yeah, I think it is. I don't know that I have the empirical evidence to show it. And it's one of the reasons you don't want to have, for example, you don't want to have a death penalty for rape because incentives matter. And if you have a death penalty for rape, the rapist now has an incentive to kill his victim. Because whether he kills her or rapes her, it doesn't matter. He gets the death penalty, right? So he will silence the witness by killing. So you want to have incrementalism in terms of the penalties. And you want, and yes, I think really harsh penalties does disincentivize. Incentives works on human beings, negative incentives as well as positive incentives. But that's not the reason you do punishment. The reason you do punishment is an issue of justice. You punish people to punish people. But the level of punishment does have to do with incentives, right? So again, I think a rapist deserves the death penalty from a moral perspective. But I don't think he should get the death penalty. Well, I'm against the death penalty generally, but I don't think he should get the same penalty as somebody who murders somebody because I don't want to provide him with negative incentive.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That makes sense. All right. Jonathan?
It just reminded me quickly, I think there's in the Q&A from the 78 lectures, one of the questioners asked Dr. Peacock and Ms. Rand is sitting there, does objectivism believe in retributive justice, retributive punishment? And Ms. Rand says, oh, yes, of course, something in that fact. I'm butchering it,
yeah.
You'll look that up in the 78 lectures.
Yeah, it's an issue of justice. You do something bad, you deserve something bad happen to you.
I will skip myself, your own, actually, and go to your piling up super chats.
Okay, let me do these last two super chat questions, and then I think we're at an hour and a half, which is too long, according to everybody. Anyway, the questioner says, I visited a place called Bury the Hatchet, in which people can rent space in the club and throw axes at targets. Apparently, bowling isn't enough. Is this a sign of growing affluence in our culture? Affluence, I don't see that. My guess is it's a game that the Vikings started when they were really, really, really poor and bored, and they would throw axes at trees. I think it's a sign of, I don't know that affluence is the right word. The people are bored. The people don't know what to do with themselves. The people are seeking, you know, weirder and weirder physical challenges, I guess, right? Because the physical challenges they face are either not enough or they want the, what's the word I'm looking for? There's something different. There's something unique. They crave that for some reason. But I think that's usually a sign of life's not that interesting for them, right? Go read a book, guys. Stop throwing axes at targets and go read a book. And if you want to practice self-defense, you know, get a gun and go to the range. But why are you throwing axes, really? I can't condemn it, but it does seem to me like a bored culture. Oh, thanks for the extra $10. Let's see, I had one more. Oh, no, two more super chat questions on here. Why should government provide free security services? Isn't that wealth transfer? That's the job of government. And they're not free. You are paying for them. Some people might free ride. And in other places, I've talked about how to deal with the free riding issue. That is, they might not pay and still get those security services. But the role of government is to protect individual rights. The idea of free or expensive or how much you pay for it that's a market issue. Government is not a market phenomena. Government is the monopoly over the use of force in a particular geographic area over anyway, I lost the word. I lost my thought there. But so you can't apply a concept of market like free. It's not providing it for free. It's getting paid, but it's not making a profit because the whole idea of profit, price, all of these things are market issues that do not relate. You cannot use those concepts with regard to government. So the issue of free riders can be addressed through social ostracizing and through other means, but the government's job is to provide security services over a particular geographic area. That is its purpose. Somebody will have to pay for that, obviously, but that payment will have to be voluntary since I don't believe in coercion. If you're interested in the whole, let me just say this. If you're interested in the whole anarchy issue, I got roped into doing debates on anarchism, something I think I swore never to do, and I did it. I did it in Poland during this trip, and I did it for two reasons. One, it was kind of a last-minute change, and I didn't want to cancel my event. I had flights, and I was arranged to be there. And second, there were a lot of anarchists in Poland, and I wanted to have something out there that clearly stated my view on anarchism. And I'm going to put up that video, so you will be able to see this debate. It'll be put up probably next week. We'll put up the video. I consider anarchism as a social system about as evil as communism and fascism. And the consequences are equally as bad. People die. Lots of people die. It's impossible to create, to produce, to build, to make anything. And I articulate my case for that in this debate, and you will have to listen to this. So all these issues about why government provides free security services are trying to go around the central issue, which is altruism. Anarchy is essentially gang warfare, and gang warfare is anti-human life and therefore needs to be rejected totally, completely, unambiguously. It is not a legitimate point of view. That's why I never wanted to debate it. I don't consider it a debatable issue. It's a stupid issue. Go study some history. Think about how human beings behave. Think about the consequences of the actions of what you have, the system you're actually advocating for. Now, I don't want to insult the people who hold this because I think a lot of young people hold this innocently. That's why I did the debate. But hopefully the debate will cover most of the points you guys have confusions about. And I would love to get to a day where nobody ever mentions the contradiction in terms called anarcho-capitalism. There is no such thing. You cannot have capitalism and anarchy at the same time. Capitalism requires government. There is no capitalism without government. Anyway, if you're interested, you can watch the debate when I put it up. Time Warp asked, and this is the last question, is Texas significantly freer than California? No, not significantly. Partially because they're both under federal law, and most of what restricts our freedom comes from the federal government, not from the state governments. And so it's not significantly freer. It certainly is freer economically. It's not freer if you want to have an abortion. There are probably other aspects of the state that are not freer. But economically, it is freer. Significantly is too strong of a word because, I just don't think it's significantly anything in the United States is significantly freer from anything else. You're still stuck with paying federal taxes. You're still stuck with federal regulations. You're still stuck with federal control. You're still stuck with federal subsidies. You're still stuck with, federal bailouts. And that's true of California and Texas and everywhere else. So it doesn't free you from that. So while it's freer, I don't know about significantly. Now, if you're in a top tax bracket in California, you're paying 13% of your income to California. In Texas, you pay zero. In that sense, you might feel freer, although other taxes are higher in Texas than they are in California, so like property taxes. All right. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks, Jonathan. Thanks, Darius, for your support on Patreon. For all of you other supporters on Patreon, thank you. For those of you who do not yet support me on Patreon, please do so. I'd very much appreciate it. It makes possible all these shows. Some of you have noticed that I've put up a lot of content over the last few weeks, and there's a lot more to come. I'm taking all my old videos and putting them up on my YouTube channel. If you appreciate that, if that is of value to you, help make that possible by supporting me on Patreon. We'll be doing a lot more live shows now that I'm not traveling like a maniac. Probably do something on the weekend. We'll do something on Monday. And then I'm traveling to the East Coast. But we'll be doing stuff. So I'll probably see you all over the weekend. And I'll be answering some of the other questions from the Patreon contributor topics that I didn't get to today. I'll be answering them on the weekend. Thanks, guys. Share the video. Share. Most important thing you can do on social media is share. Liking doesn't count. Nothing else counts. What counts is sharing. So please share and please subscribe to my YouTube channel if you haven't already. See you all on the weekend. Bye, everybody. Bye, guys.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.